This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Science fiction and fantasy have traditionally created worlds of aliens, robots, and monsters of various sorts. And there was a time when readers might be stereotyped as nerds and geeks. But now, sci-fi is exploding in the mainstream, with box office, blockbusters, and video games gaining popularity with users of all demographics. The expanding audience for sci-fi, thrillers, and fantasy is not limited to digital media. Authors who were once niche writers are now mainstream. And three of the leading authors in the genre will be reading at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville this weekend. Jeff and Ann Vandermeer are a husband and wife team who write and edit science fiction. They're also instructors at Shared Worlds, and they've just released a new anthology called The Big Book of Science Fiction. Jeff and Ann, welcome back to the State of Things.
So happy to be here.
Also joining me is Dutch author Thomas Ulhevelt. How did I do, Thomas?
That's pretty good.
Not so bad. Okay, Thomas is actually the author of the new horror book, Hex. Hex was just released to American audiences. He's going to be working with students at a school, a workshop that we're talking about in a couple of minutes, the Shared Worlds workshop. And Thomas, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And you have been editing science fiction for years now. What do you see as the distinguishing characteristic of that genre? What are you looking for when you put work in your anthology?
Well, science fiction is fiction of the future, even if the future is just 5 minutes from now. So what I'm looking for when I'm looking for a great science fiction story is I'm looking for a story that speaks to me on a personal level. You know, of course, we all love the gadgets and we all love the science and all of that. But if you don't have that personal interest, if you don't have a character that you can relate to, then it's just a story about gadgets and it's not as appealing to me. So that's what I'm really looking for when I am picking out a story. I am trying to connect with the characters, and it doesn't matter if the character is a human or a robot or an alien or even a sentient plant, as long as you can see a bit of humanity in there and connect with them. That's what I look for.
Jeff, I talked about the explosion of sci-fi and fantasy into what I would call mainstream. What do you think has made that happen, increase in popularity recently?
Well, it's just been a kind of a gradual process that's led to kind of an explosion in terms of pop culture. There are so many pop culture sites now that can kind of give information to readers, and there's such a cross-pollination between the different media. I think that's one thing. The other thing is that in science fiction, we've had an explosion of international and more diverse writers entering the field in the last 10, 15 years, and that's kind of changed the face of it. And also, we've also had the impulse from the mainstream, like Margaret Atwood's science fiction novels have kind of broken some barriers and opened some doors. And now you see more and more science fiction writers being published by mainstream literary imprints, and you just see much more of a conversation back and forth.
Well, Anne just talked about the importance of character and being able to identify with a character in sci-fi. But I guess what we've come to really think about is when we think about sci-fi, are the plots this way of understanding our present by looking at, you know, the trajectory that we're on? In that sense, you talk about Margaret Atwood, the plot has always played an important part in sci-fi, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it's true that there's a pulp American tradition that comes out of, with really exciting adventure stories, but then also wedded sometimes to like science fiction horror and sometimes to conceptual stories. And sometimes you could call the history of science fiction the history of industrialization, because we have a lot of stories in the Big Book of Science Fiction that kind of chart that progress from people having utopian visions of technology to visions that are more dystopian at the beginning of this 20th century, when, you know, of course, factories were gearing up and everything else, all the way through to now, where, you know, we're both excited about the possibility of robotics, but we're also kind of concerned that they might take over.
What do you look for when you're putting together the Big Book of Science Fiction, for instance? What kind of blend of stories are you looking for? And Anne, Jeff. Yeah, either one.
I think that, it's easy to get focused on the dystopias because conflict in that nature seems to be kind of, you know, it creates automatic conflict to put people in kind of a pessimistic scenario. But we actually have a lot of utopian science fiction. Paul Schierbart, an Austrian author, pre-World War One was creating these utopian visions of a future that were ecologically sound and all these other things. So it's really quite interesting to see early on in science fiction this impulse to already look around and say, hey, what we need for the future is we need to be more environmentally conscious, we need to do all these other things. So we mix that with a lot of funny stories, actually. There's a great tradition of humor in science fiction. It goes well beyond Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And so you get away from having like a monotone of stories about a certain kind of thing by mixing in the funny stories, making sure you're dealing with the serious topics, and then also a blend of different kinds of things, the plot-driven stories, but then also science fiction stories that are almost like fairy tales.
Well, Thomas, you write mostly horror stories, but I understand you had an interesting experience when you walked into a bookstore on this American tour trying to find your book under that category. Not always easy, huh?
Well, what I like about it is that it's actually in the new fiction in the mainstream sections. And what's striking is that you don't only find my book there, but I found Stephen King's new book there, Joe Hill's new book, Stephen Graham Jones, several others who write dark fiction like I do, either dark fantasy or horror, and they're all in the mainstream section, and that's what I like. And I, to get back to what you said before, I think it's also partly due to that we had a whole big generation of Harry Potter readers who actually grew up now, and they're not averse to the idea of stories with the fantastic anymore, which older generations might have been. So I think that's also part of why it's more mainstream now.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I called your fiction horror. The bookstores have put it in new fiction.
It's pretty scary,
fiction.
Yeah.
It is pretty scary. How do you identify it, and sort of how do you approach your writing? What do you think about, and how do you want your work to come out?
I don't label it myself. When I try to write short fiction, it tends to be pretty light and funny and I guess you could call it magic or realism. I won a Hugo Award for it last year, although I don't really write science fiction. But when it grows longer and longer, it tends to be dark. I don't know why that is, but you know, it's just something in me. I like creepy stories. I like to creep readers out.
Maybe you just get sadder and sadder because your book isn't finished yet.
I actually enjoy creeping readers out. I mean, I get all these messages from first readers in Holland when the book came out there that, you know, you bastard, I had to sleep with the lights on. And then now I get that same over here in America and all around the world where the book's published. So that gets me going.
Well, do you have to scare yourself? Do you have to surprise yourself as you're writing? Or do you kind of know how scary it's going to get?
Oh, yes, you surprise yourself a lot. It's not really you scare yourself because it's a kind of a different process in your mind when you create stuff or actually when you're undergoing stuff, when you're watching a movie or reading a book. But then, you know, anytime you write a really creepy scene and you're so deep into it, you're in a flow and you're concentrated on it, and then a branch would hit the window and you just startle up, and then you know you're on the right track.
Hey, your book has been translated in English. It's now in American bookstores. How is that? Is that writing distinct? Do you have to do anything to get your book in translation? Do anything to the original?
Definitely. It doesn't happen a lot that European authors get translated into English. And it's, like Jeff said, there is more and more international science fiction and fantasy and horror nowadays, also in U.S. markets. But we had a long process. I actually relocated the novel for an American setting, the original set in Holland. But the reason why I did that is because to really scare your readers, you need to create this perfect sense of familiarity and then destroy it.
Oh,
and
that's
felt
interesting.
You have to creep, crawl under people's skins. And I
right.
thought that if you have a setting in a country that you don't know a lot about, you're just wondering about how you pronounce their names, what's the norm for these people,
right.
and therefore what's not the norm, so what scares them. I found that would be in the way of actually scaring you, and that was the first thing I wanted to go for.
And even if you wanted to create, if it was a Dutch-looking neighborhood and it didn't look American, and you know, then the idea that I'm not, that doesn't seem normal to me. Yeah, it's fascinating
yeah.
to think about you had to do that. In fact, I understand that it took you less time to write the book than it did to make those changes. Am I right about that? Or at least to get the book
yeah,
translated.
Yeah, the first version of the Dutch version took me about 4.5 months to write, and the American edition took us, and that's me and a translator, Nancy Forrest Fleer, she's amazing, took us about a year.
And you and Jeff and Thomas are actually going to be presenting a workshop in South Carolina. Tell us a little bit about the workshop and how that goes, because you're working with young writers, right?
Yes, we are working with high school students, and they come here for 2 weeks. In the first week, they gather together in groups of 10, and they create their own fantasy or science fiction world. They just create these worlds. with various different writing exercises and other kinds of lectures that they get to help them to create believable worlds. And then in the second week, they actually write stories in those worlds, and each of those writers, each of the students, gets to have their stories critiqued by a professional writer and then have a one-on-one session to discuss their work. So it's very unique in how we approach this with the students, and it's the best thing I do every year. I love it.
That's kind of great. So you get them to create, the first thing they have to do is sort of create an imaginary world. That can be difficult,
exactly.
Though, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the hard part? Like, whenever you say to a student, particularly kids in high school or, you know, middle school, do anything you want, create anything you want, I mean, that's when the panic begins, right?
It's like, but see, this is the thing. Is you get these kids together, they don't know each other, so they're coming together, and they have to learn how to negotiate as well. Because, you know, someone might want to have a vampire and someone might want to have a robot. Well, that might not make sense in the world. And at the end of the first week, what the kids do is they present their worlds to the rest of the camp, and then they get critiqued. Well, that doesn't make sense, or ask questions about this or something like that. So it's really kind of unique. It's almost like a mini UN, if you think of it that way. It's like a teen think tank.
Yeah, and this is the ninth year we've done Shared Worlds, which is astounding to think of. And so we have the structure in place that works really well, where they have enough freedom to relax into it, but also enough structure. And we have international students. We have students from three countries this year. We have a Finnish student, and we have the resources, for example, for the Finnish student to write in Finnish, and then we give them an English translation so they can participate in reading it in the class and things like that. So,
so they have the experience of working through translation and then hearing it back. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we try to provide as much of that as possible and form-fit it for each student. So.
What about the, because Anne and Jeff and Thomas, I'm sure you do some research for your own work. Is it the same kind of research that you would apply in a situation like this when they're creating worlds?
Well, I think, one great thing about a workshop is you have this artificial situation where you have a lot of, students in one place, so they can do group activities. You know, writing is usually a solitary thing, and usually you have more than a week to write a story and more than a week to build a world, so you compress some things and you try to focus on the things that are really important, and so they can get the experience of finishing a story, they can get the experience of doing the research. I would say that it is similar, it's compressed, and normally when I'm writing a story, at least, or a novel, there may be no element of research until after I finished a rough draft. I don't know how it is for, like, Thomas.
How about that, Thomas? Because it's in your genre, especially where you're looking at horror, and you know, there's a lot of shock value in what you write. Do you feel the need to do much research before, during, or after?
Oh, definitely. I mean, especially in a genre like this, but also in fantasy and science fiction. I mean, you deal with the supernatural, obviously, and it's striking how people easily accept the supernatural element of any story, but then send you emails about, you know, that street name, that isn't altogether right. Or, you know, we don't eat burgers like that in America. So you have to research your things, definitely. I mean, people accept anything which is weird and strange, but if you get the mundane wrong, then,
that's right.
You know.
The stuff we know, we know, you better get right. The stuff that might, you know. Yeah,
exactly. And you need that as well, because that, I mean, that creates that sense of familiarity and the believability in a story.
Well, what about, you know, I've been thinking about what Thomas said in terms of horror, the idea of creating the suburban neighborhood or that house that you recognize, and that's where the mayhem, the blood is going to come up from under those porch steps. But I need some really comfortable looking porch steps with a nice wicker rocker on the right in order to really terrify me. Science fiction, it seems to me, other forms of science fiction where we're really off on other galaxies and we're centuries in the future. And Jeff and Anne, I'll ask you. Maybe Anne, I'll put the question to you directly. You really are creating a whole other world where, in a sense, nothing but the fact that people are communicating or some beings are communicating is familiar to us. How do you solve Thomas's problem of having so little familiar to us and yet allowing us entry, allowing us to identify?
Well, I think the best stories that come out of science fiction are actually dealing with how we relate to technology as well as how we relate to each other. And you're going to have common themes that you would find in any kind of really good writing, life, death, love, loss, happiness, all of those types of things are going to be in a good science fiction story. So when Jeff and I were doing the research for the Big Book of Science Fiction, which, by the way, research is one of my favorite things because I get to read everything and I just kind of fall down the rabbit hole as I'm doing all this work. But we were looking at 100 years of science fiction. So, of course, when you do something like that and you go back to the stories that were written in the early 1900s, you want to make sure that they date well, and you want to make sure that someone in the 21st century can read that story and still relate to it and still make sense of it, and it still rings true. So that was very important to us. And we also wanted to make sure that we were showing our reading audience the entire world of what science fiction is. So in our book, it's not just the space operas and it's not just the alien first contact stories, but as Jeff was saying, we have quite a few humorous stories, but then we also have some that are more experimental, we have some that are more surreal, and we do have quite a few translations in there.
Yeah, and I think what you'll find is that at the short length especially, and there's some stories in here that are like 3,000 words, it's okay to be strange. It's okay to lead with that. In short fiction, you can get away with that in science fiction. The thing that we tried to avoid is include stories that kind of were like fan fiction and that they also name-checked authors, other authors from the period. There are joke stories that don't really hold up anymore. But, you know, there are some things that are genuinely strange in here. It's totally fine to just lead with that on occasion.
As you look at the arc of science fiction writing over that 100 years, Jeff, I'll stick with you for a minute. Is there a trend line? Is there some sort of fundamental change that you could track and describe over that period?
Well, I think there's this continued struggle to deal with industrialization and technology, the good and the bad, and it gets internalized as the century progresses. So at the beginning, it's about factories and weird futuristic factories and things like that, and then later on, it's literally people becoming robots and dystopias based on that, and worried that you're too connected to the internet and things like that. So, you know, sometimes long before things like, you know, Google and social media came along, I mean, you see some Latin American stories from the 70s that kind of predict that. So you see that struggle. And then you also see, really interestingly, that the environment and ecology has been very important to science fiction for a long time. And it's actually made some stories that were quite obscure in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even before that read fresh today, and they're in this book. There's one by a writer named Wallace, that's his last name, called Student Body. That's a brilliant description of astronauts landing on a distant planet and encountering an invasive species that they do not recognize as such and the terrible consequences of that. And that was written in the 1950s, and the story was completely ignored at that time, but it's much better, to be quite honest, than some of the award-winning stories from that year. So you find things like that. That's kind of the resurrection that you do as an anthologist in terms of testing everything.
And is it getting harder and harder to write this stuff because of the rate of technological change?
No, I don't think it's getting harder. I think it's actually exploding and getting more prevalent in the world. I think you're seeing more and more people looking at different ways. The thing about science fiction that I love so much is that you can tackle very challenging and difficult issues in a science fiction story without hitting somebody over the head with the politics of it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you're able to do is present a story that people get pulled and sucked into, and then at the end they start thinking about it, mulling over their head, oh, well, taking a look at what's going on today, what's happening with the election, and what's happening over in Europe with Brexit and all that kind of stuff. You can think about those types of things in science fiction without it being so obvious.
I want to thank.
And I just think you're going to see more and more people playing around with that.
It's good stuff, and I want to thank you both, all three of you, in fact, for being on the program. Anne and Jeff Vandermeer are writers and editors. Their latest book is The Big Book of Science Fiction. They are working with students at the Shared Worlds program at Wofford College in South Carolina. Thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thomas Oldehaveld is an author of the novel Hex, just released here in the U.S., also part of the Shared Worlds program. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff, Anne, and Thomas, they're authors, and they will be reading at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville Saturday, beginning at 5 o'clock, and we have all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. There's more of the program ahead. Stay tuned.